Thank you. Thank you for standing by. At this time, the call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone, to the Charm Telecon for October 2006. Today's topic is compositional mapping of Saturn's satellites with Cassini-Venz, and we are joined today by Dr. Roger Clark. He's a team member of the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Clark.
Hello. Let's see, as the title says, I'm going to talk about Saturn satellites, and in particular the composition of the satellites. And in general, the satellites are very icy objects. I'm not going to discuss Titan today. I'm going to talk about the icy satellites, just because there's too much to fit in one talk. Titan could be several talks in itself. So the icy satellites, while they're composed mostly of ice, there are contaminants on them, and that's been the focus of our study. We've known for decades that the satellites are icy from Earth-based telescopes and spectroscopy of the satellites. So going to slide two, let's see. this was the original title of my talk, but a lot of the content of this talk will be in a paper that will be submitted to ICARUS pretty shortly. So most of the stuff here is either public domain or going to be in this paper. So let's go to slide three, and this just shows some of the complexity that we're dealing with. And while you've seen many complex pictures, and I'm sure many of you have seen this image before, it illustrates some of the problems that we have in trying to do spectroscopy. It's easy to take pictures, but when you have things shining light on other things and casting shadows and all kinds of stuff, in spectroscopy, you see those signatures, and you have to be sure that you're not contaminating a spectrum with something else. For example, Mimas is showing in this one image, is shown in the toward the upper right, and Saturn behind it would be shining light onto Mimas, and so trying to get a spectrum of Mimas may be pretty difficult without the contaminated Saturn shine. So then, and some things may be obvious in the visible, but not in other, in the infrared. So trying to figure out the scattered light has been a far more complex issue than we've thought we would have to deal with. And to illustrate this a little better, this next, we're on slide three, and it's kind of obscure geometry here, but if we zoom out a little to another view, it gives a better view of the Saturn system here with the rings edge on, and the light from the sun is from the lower right shining up through the rings, casting a shadow onto the disk of Saturn. And that's slide four. Then if we go to slide five, we get a similar view from VIMS, and here we see that not only does Saturn reflect solar light in at long wavelengths, in this case in red is the 5-micron thermal emission. So if we're studying, for example, a spectrum of a satellite, there could be thermal emission scattered light onto the satellites, and trying to interpret that would add more complications. And since the satellites are pretty close to Saturn, this is a continual problem that we're having to deal with. I think many have probably seen this picture because it's been press released, but it's a pretty cool effect of all the issues that we have to deal with in general. For as an analogy for scattered light, if you're studying the moon, when the moon is a crescent, you often see Earthshine. And that Earthshine, if you were trying to take spectra of the moon, even on the lit portion of the moon, there's Earthshine on that part too. And with spectroscopy, you would see spectral features due to Earth and in your spectra of the moon. And you might say, oh, there's oxygen on the moon, which would be incorrect. We've had a number of times when we thought we might be detecting some organic compounds on both Saturn's rings and the satellites, and it's turned out to be scattered light. We have definitely detected some organic compounds on some of the satellites, but we've had quite a few false alarms where we had to back off. so we're tracking the scattered light issue pretty carefully. Let's move on to slide six. I prepared this talk before seeing all the CHARM talks, and Trina, I did a whole bunch of downloads of the CHARM talks in the last couple of days and saw that others, I think Kevin may have shown this slide. Anyway, VIMS is it's an imaging system that has 352 wavelengths compared to the like a digital camera only has three. And the field of view of VIMS is nominally half by a half milliradian, and that equals 1.7 arc minutes. And then it has high resolution modes that doubles the IR in one dimension and triples the VIS in both dimensions. And so to a first approximation, what VIMS sees would be like if you were standing on the spacecraft looking out, you would see about the detail that VIMS sees. When you see these pictures from the imaging camera, especially the narrow angle camera, that's like looking through a small telescope from the spacecraft, if you were standing on the spacecraft with a small telescope. But VIMS is more like standing there and just looking out. Let's see, I'll go on unless there are questions that come up. The wavelength range, 0.35 to 5.2 microns, allows us in the infrared to see the absorption bands due to stretching of molecules, and in particular water and CH-bearing compounds. The CH stretch, the OH stretch, the NH stretch, and ammonia compounds all occur in this wavelength regions, and spectroscopy is quite sensitive to these compounds, so we can detect them at pretty low abundances. Let's go to slide 7. So I'm going to discuss the icy satellites, and this is a overview of the Saturn system, and I'll start from the outermost major satellite, Phoebe, and work my way in, skipping Titan, and I'll really not talk about the very small satellites. VIMS is getting spectra of the small satellites, and for the most part, they're pretty pure ice. The one theme that will come out of this is that while there are contaminants, like you see the dark stuff on Iapetus, and Phoebe is pretty dark, as we move in toward the rings, the ice gets on the surfaces gets purer and purer, and we have the purest ice in Saturn's rings, which it's an interesting conclusion and may have some global implications for the Saturn system. So let's go to slide 8, which is the ISS views of Phoebe, and Phoebe is a very dark object. It's got some, in the finest details of the imaging system, there are layers that show in the crater walls. So there are compositional variations that are implied, but in the next slide, slide 9, we see how rich the spectra really are. This was published in Nature in May 2005, and it's just the global average. And the spectrum is pretty complex, and we don't understand everything yet. And the Phoebe flyby, our data are noisier than what we're getting on more recent data from all the satellites. And I want to point out just a few of the spectral features. A few of them, like F2, 3, and 4, have turned out to be calibration errors and are not real. And in our newer data, that spectral region is smooth. F6 and 9 are water bands, and there's two kinds of water in there. There's both water ice and bound water. That's H2O molecules attached to other compounds on the surface. F11 is a very interesting feature that's called the 2.42 band, and you'll see me refer to that quite a lot. It may be related to cyanide compounds, and initially after the Phoebe flyby, we identified it pretty solidly as matching cyanide compounds, and to this day, cyanide compounds are the only compounds that match, but there are other absorptions that cyanide compounds should have that we don't always see, so that may not be a cyanide compound. It may be some other compound that we just have never measured on Earth so far.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yep.
Could you briefly describe the concept of absorption and how it shows up in this graph in terms of magnitude?
Basically any wiggle, any dip from some trend like that F11, there's a peak just to the left of F11. That's the maximum in the whole spectrum. And then the spectrum is coming down, and then it suddenly drops, giving where F11 is pointing. That is a little absorption feature, and whether something is significant or not in spectroscopy, a little feature could be quite important. So a lot of these little wiggles here, depending on what they are, may or may not be significant and could be major discoveries. For example, let's go over to F18. There's a little tiny dip there in the trend, and there's a big broad thing going from about 3.8 to 5 microns called F21, and that's a big broad thing. That's a big broad absorption band, mostly due to water. But F18 is very interesting because it's due to a nitrile. A nitrile is a CH compound with a CN molecule attached to it, or a CH bond, or CN bond attached to it. So,
Roger, could you maybe give like the 1 minute summary of what's physically happening with the atom that creates an absorption line?
It's very simple. It's think of two masses in a spring. So if you have two masses in a spring, and depending on the how much each mass weighs and the strength of the spring, if you hit it, it'll vibrate. And it's the same with molecules. You hit it with a photon, and if the photon matches the resonant energy of that spring plus mass, the spring being the chemical bond and the masses being the atoms, then the atoms will vibrate at that frequency. So like F18, what's happening is there's a CN molecule, and when a photon hits it at that wavelength, it is a resonance that sets up the vibration. And in spectroscopy, you need a dipole moment for the electric field of the photon to interact with the molecular bond or chemical bond. So things like N2, there's no dipole moment because they're both the same, N and N, and you don't tend to get, well, you don't get any absorption bands due to nitrogen. For example, through Earth's atmosphere, we can look out through most wavelengths because there's no nitrogen absorptions. We do or can't look out through the atmosphere where there's the oxygen and hydrogen vibrate, and that's quite a few lines in the infrared. Basically, where there's F6, F9, and F12, those are water bands, and in the Earth's atmosphere, like the F12 region, is completely opaque to viewing. So spectroscopy is very sensitive to these molecular bonds and light elements for the near infrared. If you want to do heavier elements like silicates, then it's better to go out into the longer wavelengths, into the mid infrared. So every wavelength region has its strengths. Does that clear that up okay?
Yeah, that was great. Thanks.
Okay. So anyway, the Phoebe spectrum turns out to be quite rich in features. We don't understand everything yet. And in fact, the F8, F9, and F10, we're going to see that complex over and over again, and we'll see the F11, and the other one that's important here is F17, is CO2, and we know from the position of that it's not free CO2, it's not CO2 frost, it's CO2 trapped in other minerals. The F6, F9, and F12 are the water bands, and ammonia also has absorptions there, so sometimes there could be significant amounts of ammonia contributing to those absorptions also. But ammonia, if there's too much of it, it has other absorptions, and we basically have not detected ammonia.
Do you know how to mute a cell phone?
Star 6.
Star 6 worked there too.
Yep.
While there could be a fair amount of ammonia here, we can't directly detect it unless it becomes fairly abundant, like 10% or more. The other interesting feature, which you'll see repeated, is F13 is a peak instead of an absorption. And that is due to where the OH molecule has a resonant frequency called the fundamental. Some of these are combinations and overtones of different modes. If you think of music and you think of overtones with music, this is the F13 is the fundamental OH stretch vibration for OH, and that is where it's such an intense absorber, it actually reflects light like a metallic mirror. It's just a strange property of all materials have this, these kind of things. Okay, let's go to the next slide, because we could talk about this forever and really get bored. So using all those features, just like in a digital camera, you have three channels. VIMS has 352 channels. So every pixel, we have a complete spectrum. And while our spatial resolution isn't as high as the imaging system, we still have pretty decent resolution when we get close. And so these are our maps produced for Phoebe. Every one is minus 180 to 180 degrees longitude and minus 90 to plus 90 latitude. We did not observe the northern section, so all the maps are blank there. So we got the southern pole up through a little beyond the equator into the north a little bit. So these just show examples of the kind of maps we can make. And like A is just intensity at 1 micron wavelength. And then B is the strength of the 2 micron ice feature. So this is a map of ice abundance. And it's a combination of ice abundance and ice grain size. So spectroscopy will change the strength of absorption bands depending on both the depth and the grain size of the material. So, and using multiple absorption bands, we can sort out which is which, so we can map both abundance and grain size, which is pretty cool. what's some of the others? The CO2 absorption down there in G has, there's two maps. There's the general global view, and then the close-up picture just below it that shows the small craters. And one thing that was curious in the CO2 absorption map is there's a dark line, meaning less CO2, that is some geologic structure that extends over the length of the image. And that we don't understand, but in general, a lot of the moons have a lot of long-range fractures in them, so this must be one of those fractures being illustrated there. Phoebe does have some organics that's shown in panel F there, and they seem to be concentrated in one area. Let's see, the ice in general is, as you might expect, is more abundant at the South Pole than it is at the equator, but there is ice all over the place. And where there's not ice, most of Phoebe's surface has to be 80 or 90% ice everywhere, because we see the ice absorption everywhere. Even though it's very dark, and this will be a repeated theme, think of charcoal. If you're say barbecuing and you get some charcoal on your finger and you smear your shirt, that smear shows up very easily, even though you're not putting much abundance of charcoal onto your shirt. Any dark material at a given wavelength will dominate, because when a photon hits it, it gets absorbed. Whereas, like in a white shirt, the photons can go in, hit the shirt, and bounce around on different fibers and then be scattered away. But the dark materials dominate, so it's a very nonlinear effect. So even though you have a very dark surface, it can still be very abundant with a bright material like water ice. Although water ice isn't bright at all wavelengths, it's only bright to us in the visible, where we see it. Okay, let's go on to slide 12. Oops, let's see. I think I pushed the wrong button here on my computer. We were... slide 11, excuse me. Okay, so using some of the compounds from slide 10, you can combine those into different colored, like a sign, water to green or blue in this case, like panel I shows. Blue is the water ice strength, green is that little 2.42 micron band, the strength of it, and red is, if you want to jump back to the slide 9, it's feature F1, a big broad feature that appears to be due to ferrous-bearing minerals. Go back to slide 11. So these are just some examples of some of the things you can do, and from there, these might show you geologic units that you can then help interpret the geologic history of the object. And we have more papers coming out on things like this. We'll have one on Enceladus coming out shortly that will have more of this kind of stuff. And in that case, mapping the ice grain sizes. Let's go on to Slide 12. So these are some of the conclusions for mapping Phoebe. Again, at the top, we're dominated by water ice. We also have bound water. Those are water molecules that are bound, chemically bound to other minerals. We have the trapped CO2. We have the broad 1 micron feature, which appears like Fe2+, although we've actually come up with a novel new explanation, and we're trying to verify this. It's certainly a possibility, and it will be hard to prove if it's correct or not. But that is, if you have small grains of dark material embedded in ice, and those grains are smaller than visible wavelengths, toward the UV, it'll cause what's called Rayleigh scattering and cause a blue increase, much like we see our sky is blue due to Rayleigh scattering off of molecules in the Earth's atmosphere. So this effect, we've observed it in the lab now, and it appears similar to what we're seeing on Phoebe. So instead of this broad absorption being due to an Fe2+, it might be a flat reflectance material like carbon that doesn't actually increase in the blue, but the blue is caused by scattering. And we're trying to verify that. I'm not sure if we'll be able to. We'll probably just have to put it down as another explanation. Science doesn't always give all possible explanations uniquely. So we also see a 2.2 micron feature, which is most likely due to phyllosilicates, that's clays. Phyllosilicates are commonly seen in meteorites, so this isn't an unusual finding. It just extends further out into the solar system where we're finding these. Then this 2.42 micron feature, which we're still wondering if it's cyanide compounds. At present, it's our only explanation, but we're really confused by it. We can't reproduce it exactly in the lab, so we're trying hard to do that. We see organic compounds due to this 3.3 micron set of features. Again, the features don't exactly match things that we have in the lab, but organic compounds are the only things that match in this area. We have a 3.6 micron feature, which is, I think, is probably also an organic compound, but we don't have a match for it either. We have these broad absorptions, which we don't have exact matches for. They're probably water-related, could be NH, ammonia-related, just confusing. I didn't put on this slide, down at the bottom, the nitrile, the 4.51 micron feature. That's pretty solid because it's a very sharp, narrow line, and it's right on the position of known nitriles, so it's probably a very good identification. So let's move on to the next object in the Saturn system, and that's Iapetus. One of the big questions that Cassini was hoping to answer is the one side of Iapetus is dark and one side is bright. And we will have a very close flyby coming up in September 2007 where we should get the definitive data. But the spectroscopy of Iapetus is kind of curious because from the Earth, Phoebe has this blue upturn, so the blue shape of the spectrum does not match that of Iapetus. Iapetus's spectrum toward the UV doesn't go up like Phoebe does. So people have argued, well, it's a different material. Well, let's go to the next slide? So more slide 14. What is the source of this albedo dichotomy? The question is it stuff coming from Phoebe? Is it stuff coming from Titan or Hyperion? Or is it stuff that was from Iapetus itself? So there's a lot of questions on the origin of this material. And another option is all of this stuff has come in from outside the Saturn system. Well, let's go to slide 15. Some of the evidence for coming from external to Iapetus is the ISS. These are the camera views from our first sort of close flyby, and we see these what look like wind streaks of this dark material, so like it's being blown onto the surface, so it does appear to be coming externally. And there's probably several people who will argue different positions even based on that, but I'm not going to get into that. I'm going to go, let's go to slide 16 and look just at the spectra and see what that says. Well, right off the bat, we see that we have the 2.42 micron feature, and we have the trapped CO2 feature, and then we have what's marked there around 2 microns, three features. We also see those same three features on Phoebe, and then note that as you go toward the short wavelengths, the spectrum of Iapetus is very smooth and continues down. I didn't plot the UV, but it continues down all the way down to the shortest wavelengths that VIMS measures. And the spectrum is very smooth there compared to Phoebe in the 1 micron region. That's reflecting the new calibration that we have now, and the Phoebe spectrum looks smooth there too now. Trying to do calibration is very difficult. So at 3 microns, we have the huge absorption band, same kind of thing that we see on Phoebe. Then over at 4.9 microns, we have this change in the spectrum that is labeled the XCN. This actually is some of the stronger evidence that that plus the 2.42 feature are due to CN, that this structure out at 4.8 microns is very similar to structure in spectra seen in interstellar clouds, where the interstellar astronomers are calling it XCN. And unfortunately, we don't have whatever that material is, at least here on Earth, measured in the lab to reproduce that exactly. So that's why I keep putting question marks on these things. I would like to see a good, solid lab spectrum that matches it exactly, because the problem with spectroscopy is you can be close and not quite, and if it's not quite, it may be something completely different that we haven't measured yet, because too many things have features in the same place, like that 2.42 feature, even though nothing else that we have in our labs match the CN position. There are clays and even some organics that have absorptions near there, but not exactly there. So it's very disconcerting until you match it exactly. And this kind of stuff has plagued spectroscopy for many years. For example, the SO2 discovery on the volcanoes on Io, Jupiter satellite, it took a huge effort to figure out what it was a 4-micron band, 4.03 microns, to figure out that that was CO2, because the spectra hadn't been measured for that compound in that wavelength range. So it's there's just too many compounds to measure and too little funding to get it all done very quickly. So even though we've been working at it for 30 years, we're still working at it. So anyway, though, the interesting part is we have many absorption bands in both Phoebe and Iapetus that are in common. So the only thing that isn't in common is the XCN step. It shows a little bit in some Phoebe spectra, but not as well as it does in Iapetus, and the blue upturn in the Phoebe spectrum is different. And if that was explained by this Rayleigh scattering due to dispersal in ice, it could completely explain the spectrum that the stuff on Phoebe and the stuff on Iapetus is the same material. We know to some degree at least some of it is the same. We don't know if all of it is the same yet. So it's still an open question on what's coming from where, and we're continuing to address that.
Quick question. So would you say these are not simple nitriles then? These would have to be more complicated, more complex, higher molecular weight?
No, they actually have to be simple, because as you get to more complex materials, you get more absorption bands. And in fact, the Iapetus spectrum here, look at the four all the way out to 5 microns, there's a lot of little structure there. That's not noise. That's real. It's all real. And even go over and look at the 2.42 band, and just short of that, let's see, what wavelength is that? About 2.2 microns. There's a little teeny dip. Even that's real. Essentially, everything in the spectrum is real. and we can't explain most of it.
Well, if it's, I don't understand if it's not a simple one. I mean, you know the spectra of that. Why would you not conclude it's not a simple nitrile then?
It has to be a simple nitrile.
Yeah, right.
Because a more complex one would have other absorption bands that would occur where we would detect them and we don't see it.
Right, but I guess you said you're not even certain, so I guess...
No, the nitrile does match it exactly. It's a nitrile that is unique to nitriles, and so it has to be a nitrile. Okay?
Right.
For example, let's see, like blue nitrile rubber gloves, that's an organic compound that has a CN attached to it. Nitriles, by the way, are very, very tough materials. The blue nitrile rubber glove has huge absorption bands in the 3.2 to 3.4 micron region, somewhere in there, I forget exactly where. Huge absorptions that are bigger than the nitrile band, and so we would detect it. And the spectra of Iapetus and Phoebe are pretty smooth through there, so there can't be much in terms of these complex organic compounds. They have to be a pretty small amount. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, let's see, going to slide 17. So here's a summary between Iapetus and Phoebe. So we have the cyanide compounds, the 2.42 and the 4.8 micron features. We have trapped CO2 that looks the same. We have bound water and trace organics that appear similar. So far, and we haven't gotten our good look at Iapetus, but so far, BB has more diversity in the compounds, and then, you know, like the nitriles is a pretty strong feature on BB and not on Iapetus. We also, what I didn't show in the last spectrum, Iapetus also has CO2 frost, that's free CO2 as an ice, dry ice, and we didn't detect any of that on Phoebe. So we only had a distant flyby on that one Iapetus flyby, so September of next year will give some pretty definitive data. It's looking to be a very, very spectacular flyby.
How close is it?
We're looking at changing it right now. I think currently it's like around 1,500 kilometers, and we're looking to change it to about 2,000 kilometers. The advantage is it'll give us an hour more time close in over the dark material. So we'll be able to do a much better job on it, even though we're a little bit further away. Observing time close in is a very precious resource. So sacrificing a little bit of spatial resolution for the more time will be a big help to the science. Okay?
And while you're on Iapetus, is there any reasonable explanation yet for the ridge?
I have not heard one.
Okay. Thank
you. But, yeah, I haven't actually, I've been too busy with the other stuff, but I haven't heard anybody talk about it much yet.
A lot of people ask about it, that's why I'm...
Yeah, I'm sure. I did hear something recently about a ring, that it might be a collapsed ring, but I heard that secondhand. I didn't hear the actual talk. Okay, so on to Hyperion, the sponge moon. And Hyperion is interesting. This is slide 18. It's very odd how these craters look. It looks like it's been degassed and that this is the residual material that's left. It's mostly water. It's like dirty water ice. So let's go to slide 19. And this is, again, the imaging system. And VIMS did resolve enough to get a few pixels on the bottom of these dark crater floors. Interesting in this picture is there's no small craters. They've kind of been eroded away or probably or buried or something, but that's a big mystery. And then why the crater floors are dark is also a mystery. Well, the next slide shows the spectra. The dark areas in blue there are the dark crater floors, and that we do have a couple of noise spikes to ignore, and that's at 4 microns and 4.8 microns, so ignore those things. We have a 2.42 feature, just like on Phoebe and Iapetus, at the bottom of the 2-micron band, we see the structure that shows the bound water bands, and we have a CO2 band out there at 4.25 microns. So, again, same basic compound. So the CO2 is trapped the same way. We have the same bound water and the same 2.42 feature. So, again, it's showing at least some commonality in the main dark material in the system. Let's go on to slide 22. I said I wasn't going to mention Titan. I think you have had a talk on Titan. Have you had a talk on Titan surface? I promise I'll do one on Titan surface.
Larry Soderblom gave us a talk on Titan surface.
Okay.
We're good.
We have lots of controversy on Titan surface because the atmosphere is so dense and blocks so much of the spectrum, it's very hard to understand the composition. And we're just starting to get handles on it, and you saw some indications of that from Larry. But we are chipping away at it and making some progress, and I think we'll have some good stuff coming up here in the next year. So let's go on to Rhea.
Do you believe, by the way, that the lakes are lakes?
Well, it turns out that VIMS can actually detect liquid methane and liquid ethane down to millimeters in thickness. And I did present at the DPS where we are detecting some of that. We have not had a good view of these lakes, so they sure look like lakes. Whether there's any liquid in them now, gee, I'd sure like to get VIMS over one, but we haven't had that opportunity yet. So hopefully we'll get one soon and be able to say something.
Thank
okay.
You.
So on to Rhea. Rhea is one of the bigger icy moons in the Saturn system. It's got these light wispy streaks, so there's some variations on the surface. But if we go to slide 23, for what we resolved in our one flyby, all we see is ice. We don't see anything else. This one spectrum here, it's a little funny in the 1-micron region because it's the old calibration for that region. But ignoring that, we see just a teeny trace when you really zoom in of CO2, but we don't see any hints of this 2.42 feature. Looks like pretty pure ice. So I'm going to go on to Dione. And Dione is much more interesting, and that's a large part of the focus of the paper that's about to go to Icarus. In this slide 24 here, you see that there are these wispy streaks, which nobody knew what they were after the Voyager encounter, and now the Cassini imaging team has resolved them quite nicely to be geologic structures, cracks, and perhaps faults on the surface of Dione. And so huge cliff walls are exposed where the ice is showing up as bright. And VIMS resolves these at least to some degree and confirms that the bright nature of them is pretty pure water ice. But around those, especially on the trailing side, and that's the side, the trailing side is, when the satellite is moving around in its orbit, it's a side that's behind. So if you were in a car, it would be the bumper, or it would be the trunk of the car driving down the road. So it's a little darker on the trailing side, and that dark material is a focus of our study. So let's go to slide 25. And this is the VIMS best resolution data for that flyby. And so that's about 1/40th or so of what the imaging team can do. So this is a mosaic of many frames. And what is interesting here is, let's see, if you go to slide 26, you see the terminator, and the direction of sunlight is from the lower right. But look at crater A, for example. Crater C is a little harder to see because it's kind of bright there, and some of the others you have to stand back from, but crater B, crater A is probably the best thing to look at. Crater B is dark on the left wall and bright on, bright on the left wall, dark on the right wall. But the direction of sunlight would say it should be just the opposite. So it's not a lighting effect. It's got to be dark on that right side because of the material there, not the lighting.
Comment. I noticed that if I squint my eyes, you can see that effect a lot better.
Or move back about 10 feet.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Let's see. Okay. So now go to slide 27, and this is a map of ice strength. So it's the strength of the 2-micron ice band, which again can be due to one of two things: composition, abundance, or the grain size of the ice. And in this case, by analyzing multiple ice bands, it's mostly due to the abundance of the ice or the amount of contaminants of the dark material. So looking at, let's go to slide 28 and look at crater A. On the right side of the inside of crater A, on the wall there, it's dark, meaning low abundance of ice. And on the left side inside the crater, it's bright, meaning high abundance of ice. Now, crater C, you see the same effect, and crater B is kind of too bright to see. Crater D shows the same effect. It's dark on the one side and bright on the other. All of this implies that material has been coming in from the trailing side, coating the surface as a uniform rain of material coming down. So it is arguing that the material on Dione is external to Dione itself. So if the stuff on Iapetus is similar, then both Iapetus and Dione are arguing for an external source to the dark material. So let's see. Now looking at the spectra in slide 29, it does help back there on 27, 28 to bounce back and forth and then bounce back and forth between like 25 and 27 and see the differences in the lighting versus ice abundance. You want to toggle that a little bit. So then to slide 29, we see the spectra, and the spectra have a couple of interesting properties. In the darker regions, we see the 2.42 micron band, a trace amount of CO2, but notice compared to Phoebe and Iapetus, and even Hyperion for that matter, both the CO2 and the depth of the 2.42 micron feature is much weaker. So while there's some dark material there, it's a less amount of dark material. Then the other thing that's interesting to note is that the as you go to shorter wavelengths, the plots go up, meaning it has that peak in the blue, sort of like Phoebe. So again, is this due to a ferrous iron absorber, or is this due to the Rayleigh scattering of small dispersed particles in the ice? I'm kind of intrigued by the idea of the small particles dispersed in ice, and we're trying to look at the distribution of these effects over the whole satellite and see if we can prove that or not. And so far, we haven't completed the study, so I don't know what the answer is. let's see. So I'm going to skip Tethys and Mimas. We don't detect any dark material on those, so the ice is even purer. Here's that trend. As we're getting closer to Saturn, the ice on the surface is getting purer. And we do detect very, very trace amounts of CO2 on Tethys and Mimas, but even smaller than on Dione.
Quick question about Dione, though, before you leave. What about the cracks? Now, this moon is dead now, right? It's not geologically active, and what caused them in the past?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know if it's certainly not as active like Enceladus is, but there's still suspicion that it may be contributing to the material out from it to the E-ring. And there have been some almost detections where we could almost say yes or no, but the scattered light issue is difficult, and we haven't gotten good enough data to give a definitive answer yet. So there's been some suspicions, but nothing that you can prove anything by yet.
Okay. Thank you.
okay, so on to Enceladus. probably everybody on the phone knows that Enceladus is active. So we've one thing that Cassini has confirmed is that it's geologically active and that it's a major source of material to the E-ring, and the E-ring is mostly ice, so Enceladus is spewing out mostly ice. And the next slide, 31, shows more of these cracks. Cracks that, you know, on a small scale, Dione has these, but Enceladus has them a lot more. Kind of more evidence that Enceladus is more geologically active than Dione is or was. So if Dione was or is still doing things, it's probably much less. And that's what the data is showing so far. If it is active, it's at a very, very small level compared to Enceladus. Next slide, slide 32. One of the more interesting things, I think, is the craters look soft, much like on Hyperion. So on a fine scale, whenever we've gotten close to these, and this is true for the small satellites, that there doesn't seem to be a lot of fine structure, or like that fine structure is buried, and it's probably buried in a fine dusting of ice particles. And is that, you know, what we don't know yet is that true throughout the Saturn system? As we get more and more close-ups, maybe we'll extend that trend everywhere. But like at Phoebe, we did see fine detail, but in the inner satellites, there seems to be more of this stuff coating things. So our initial look, going to slide 33, was that Enceladus was just a beautiful ice spectrum. This is all these dips here are all due to water, and just a gorgeous spectrum, matches lab data very nicely. Enceladus, because of these smooth areas and look like flow features, people have thought that the only way you can do that is have a ice ammonia mixture to reduce the freezing point of the water by as much as 100 degrees Kelvin, and that would allow these ice-ammonia mixtures to flow and give you cryovolcanism. But so far, through many attempts from both from Earth as well as VIMS, we've never detected any ammonia. And so it just makes it more curious what's driving the system and how does it keep active.
What about organics? I've read that a lot of claims that there's organics there.
Yes, there has been detection of some organics by the INMS. Did Hunter give a talk on that? Or was that on Hunter Waite?
Hunter gave a talk, but only on Titan.
Okay. I think it might be published now that INMS has detected some organics coming out of the Enceladus plumes. I don't believe that organics would depress freezing points, at least not like ammonia does. Ammonia, the NH is a nice polar bond, and when it mixes with water, you get NH3OH, and that really changes the chemistry of the system. And I'm not an organic chemist, but I don't think, at least most organic molecules, the simple ones, you could do that kind of stuff. So let's go to slide 34, and of course everybody's seen the geyser plumes. VIMS did get spectra of these plumes. They're pretty low, low signal, but enough to see that the plumes have ice signatures in them, and we're hoping to get some better spectra on some upcoming opportunities. So next slide, slide 35, shows maps of the ice strength. And in the South Polar region, in the upper left shows the ISS reference, so you see that this view is the South Pole with the Tiger Stripes. And the Tiger Stripes have a heat source there, and what happens when you have snow and a heat source is the snow grains actually increase in size with time. If you live in a cold climate, like I live in Denver, on a very cold winter day, we'll get a very fine powder snow, but after a couple of days as it warms up, that snow turns to a very granular texture. And a large part of that is grain growth due to the temperature. As the temperature goes up, the water molecules evaporate from the corners of crystal edges, and they impact on crystal faces, and the grains tend to grow. And it's a well-studied phenomenon and well-predictable. So in the South Polar region, that's exactly what we see, that the ice absorptions get stronger in the tiger stripes where the heat sources are, and the grains grow pretty much like predicted. And BEMS has a paper, one of the papers submitted to ICARUS will be on this subject. Okay, next slide. So these just show, let's see, slide 36 shows the spectra that shows the changes in the ice bands in the tiger stripes and between them. And it just shows a couple of the ice bands that are very sensitive to grain size, and the bottom curve in the tiger stripes, the curve is lower, but the bottom of the absorption band is flattened, and that flattening actually tells us when we run a model of the spectrum of ice, we can pin the grain size pretty nicely by that and by the shape of that spectrum. And that, in this case, it tells us it's on the order of a couple hundred microns or 0.2 millimeters in diameter, average diameter. So it's remote sensing at a distance at a very fine scale. Next slide. There are some areas on Enceladus that have CO2, but most of the areas do not. The global average in the black line, we're on slide 37, does not show any CO2, but a few areas do show some nice CO2 absorptions. And again, these are CO2 that is trapped, not free CO2. Slide 38. So this shows a summary of the CO2 detections, and it shows at the bottom, you see Iapetus appears twice, and you see that the CO2 band changes position. That long position, the very bottom Iapetus one, is the position of CO2 frost, and the shorter wavelengths are positions of CO2 trapped in other material. And notice that Dione and Iapetus have a shorter CO2 band than Iapetus and Phoebe. did I say that right? Dione and Hyperion, the two green lines, are shorter. So maybe that's an argument that the composition is different, or maybe it's just an indication of some other condition of the CO2 that may not be related to the overall dark material mineralogy. But we do have a trend here going from the largest CO2 bands are in the outer satellites, and as we move in to Tethys and Mimas, those are about the same. As we move in, the CO2 bands are getting smaller, so the ice is getting purer. Same with the dark material. Okay, now to Saturn's rings. So that's the last stop in solid surfaces in the Saturn system. So the problem with Saturn's rings is they're real close to Saturn, and that causes a lot of problems with scattered light, and this slide illustrates the scattered light problem. In slide A is a false color infrared image from VIMS, and slide B in red shows the methane band strength and the red shining on the rings there, where the rings are reddish in color, shows the intense scattered light from Saturn hitting the rings. So we found that, well, when we were going in, we didn't realize how bad this problem was. We knew there was going to be some effect, but VIMS is such a precise instrument, we're finding that we can see the scattered light most places in the rings. So the best place to look is on the night side of Saturn, so that we only have a problem with thermal emission from Saturn, and so depending on distance from the rings, we can or can't use the 5-micron region, but most of the spectrum is clean because the night side of Saturn is actually dark. But look where it's labeled, the figure B is labeled shadow, and along the shadow edge it's red. That's light shining through Saturn's atmosphere being refracted, and right at the shadow edge, that's where sunrise or sunset is, and you see light through the atmosphere. So we see absorption bands due to Saturn's atmosphere on the rings right there. And when we actually went into Saturn orbit insertion in July 2004, Cassini was looking down right near the ring shadow there. And in the C ring, we were actually looking in the part of the shadow where Saturn light was refracted onto the rings. And we initially thought we had discovered a lot of organics in the rings, but it turned out to be this scattered light problem. So we found that the best place to study the ring spectra and the composition of the rings is just outside that area, that on the near the shadow, but not too close, that we're in that refracted zone. So we've had to change a lot of our observations to target that area, and as the mission goes on, we'll get more and more opportunities to look at that area and get better spectra. So if we go on to slide 40, it shows the spectra of Saturn's rings.
So this conjunction that must have been a gold mine for you.
This what?
The conjunction that we just had about a month ago. Must have been an excellent data opportunity.
The Rev 28 occultation and conjunction, it was fantastic. We're hoping to have a talk on that next month.
Okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, that must have been especially favorable for your instruments, right?
We've had lately some very good opportunities to observe the rings, and as we crank up out of the... from the plane of the rings to higher orbits, we get to look down on the rings, and we'll get a lot of good spectra. And there's a lot of interesting stuff coming out on the rings. And the first part of the mission, for me at least, being a solid surfaces person, I've been dominating my time on the satellites, and now I'm finishing up those papers and going to start working more on the rings. So yes, I'm looking forward to that. And digging into the data we've already gotten, which I don't get much time to do. So let's go to slide 40. And these spectra are just textbook spectra of pure water ice. We have not detected any CO2 at all. We've had some trace hints, but we haven't been able to confirm them. It's been so weak, the any signature, basically at the noise level. So if it's there, any CO2, it's extremely weak. Most of the rings are very pure. The bright A and B rings, we've detected nothing but ice in the interior of the Cassini division. It is more dusty, and there we do see features that sort of look like Phoebe and Iapetus, but we have not detected the 2.42 band. And here you see the C ring is going down towards shorter wavelengths, and that is a little bit of the dark material, but not enough to show us if there's a 2.42 band there, and not enough to see a CO2 absorption. If we go to 41, one of the problems with detecting things besides ice in the rings is how dark they are, and this illustrates that, you know, we're on slide 41. It shows the spectrum of Dione, and Dione in the long wavelengths is 3% reflectance. For reference, carbon charcoal and carbon black is around 1.5% reflectance through this whole range and in the visible. And so you see that like at 4.5 microns, the rings are many times darker than the darkest carbon material. So water is very, very absorbing in the infrared, and it's very difficult with such low signals to see if any CO2 is there at the CO2 line position as shown. But even in our best data, averaging lots of spectra together, we have detected no CO2. So far, the rings are the purest. We have detected, did I include that? Yes, okay, next slide, 42. The F ring is an extremely interesting ring, and it shows a gorgeous 2.42 micron feature. It doesn't show any CO2, and it shows the structure much like Iapetus, so in the visible, in that toward 1 micron there. So it looks like material from Iapetus minus the CO2, and it has a new absorption at 2.85 or so. That major dip there just below 3 microns, that appears to be, in this spectrum, it's partly a transmission through the rings, and that's partly due to structure in the water ice spectrum that you normally don't see, so it's a scattering effect. So that isn't a unique identifier of something else. But that 2.42 micron feature and it is really quite unusual. So we're seeing that throughout the whole Saturn system now. We see it from Phoebe into the F-ring. And then why is the F-ring so dirty and then it's suddenly clean inside the F-ring? So it's like the F-ring is batting cleanup for the dust, you know, and dirt in the system. And even though the E-ring is pure ice, and the F-ring still has a lot of ice in it, but why is everything else so pure and the F-ring so dirty? We don't know. And with that, I'm going to go to slide 43. And let's see, slide 43 just summarizes what VIMS has found so far. So from the very outside Phoebe through Hyperion, we have a fair amount of dark material, CO2 and the possible CN compound. And then as we get in closer to the rings, things get purer. So from that, then we go to conclusions on slide 44. And again, it's the 2.42 micron feature, which we're really beating our heads on whether or not it's a cyanide. But it's pretty common throughout the system. We have the CO2 common throughout the system, but this nice trend of purity as we get closer to the rings. And with that, I'll take questions.
Question.
Okay.
This is Matthew with the Saturn Observation Campaign. It seems to me, especially when you're detecting this cyanide on these outer moons, that if you could take a moon like Phoebe and move it in towards the inner solar system, basically it would be a comet. Am I correct in this?
Well, cyanide compounds aren't necessarily volatile. You know, like a blue rubber nitrile glove is not a volatile. So it depends on the exact form of the cyanide. And until we get an exact match, we really won't know. We know it's not hydrogen cyanide. The hydrogen cyanide absorption is at 2.5 microns.
Okay.
So we know it's not hydrogen cyanide.
Yeah, I've read that they've recently detected some kind of cyanide compound on this comet Swan. I'm not sure if it's the same. Or
yeah, I think they're detecting HCN.
Thank you.
That's what's been commonly detected in comets, at least.
All right, thank you.
In the interstellar medium, there are quite a number of cyanide compounds have been discovered. They've been discovered at microwave wavelengths where they only need a few molecules synthesized in the lab to test it. And so, like, hydrogen cyanide is HCN. There's HC3N, HC5N, HC7N, all the odd numbers. And we're trying to get a hold of some of those compounds in enough abundance that we can measure a reflectance spectrum. And we need a couple of grams. And it's very difficult. And so far, we haven't been able to get them. So that might be a source of cyanide compounds that might match that. You know, we don't know yet till we do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, but
are there any other questions?
How about a question about Hyperion? What is the cause of those sponge-like appearance? Any clue?
Some people have speculated that maybe Hyperion was full of other volatiles, like maybe ammonia or something, and it all evaporated away, and so it left the sponge-like stuff. I mean, it sounds plausible. I don't know. I haven't seen a definitive paper that, you know, provides a this is the argument and it's the only argument type. So hopefully we'll see that here. I think the imaging team might have a paper on that subject being submitted to this Icarus special issue.
It's just so unique. I mean, I guess if that was the explanation, maybe there would be other moons like that. But
well, yeah. In fact, that's what's so bizarre about it. Why, I mean, that's been one of the surprises in the solar system. We so see so many different things, and yet, why don't we see, you know, more things in common that like that? You know, we've seen up close comets, and they don't look like that. So it's very unusual.
That, in a way, is related to my question. It has to do with the purity of the water ice that you're seeing. Is that because of lack of processing or a recent origin, or what's the predominant theory on that?
Well, let's see. Most of the satellites are pretty abundant in water. From their densities, typically 1.3, and ice is 1, and rock is, you know, 4 or 5. So the abundance of water, if you did a rock-water model, would be dominated by water. So one would expect them to be mostly water. And the question is, you know, while we do see a few other materials from the cosmochemists, in particular they want to see ammonia, why don't we see the ammonia? And is it a surface effect that just the small amount of ammonia that's been on the surface has evaporated away, so we're seeing the residual pure water surface, or what? But this trend of a lot of water in the outer solar system, we've known for a long time from Earth-based spectroscopy. We've known the Galilean satellites, the Saturn satellites, Uranian and Neptune satellites all have a lot of water ice exposed on the moon's surfaces. And why that is not really known. And why we don't see a lot of other stuff that's been predicted. At least we are seeing the CO2 that was predicted a long time ago, and for a long time nobody saw. And we couldn't see that CO2 line from Earth-based telescopes because CO2 in our atmosphere blocks the view.
Thank you.
You didn't do the tiny moons for a lot of obvious reasons. Any general comments you could make about them?
Well, the innermost moons, so far the spectra that we've looked at just look like pure water ice. We haven't gone in and done detailed mapping of resolved stuff on the moons. That'll be after we finish the main satellites.
Oh, they haven't been done.
I mean, we have some data, but we haven't analyzed that data for that stuff yet. Too much to do.
Is there going to be when's the close flyby of Dione, if any?
We've had our close flyby of Dione, and that's the data that I showed here for VIMS. That's the best data we will get in the tour. We may get more in the extended mission, depending on how that plays out.
That's what
it's
I'm
on our desired
right.
list.
Right. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Excellent.
Okay. Are there any more questions? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank Roger for joining us today. We really appreciate it. We understand, you know, all these scientists on Cassini are very busy, and we always appreciate it when you could take an hour to talk with us. The next Charm Telecon is tentatively the Rev-28 occultation data. This, we had some spectacular data that was taken on the rings and Saturn itself while the sun was behind. Again, we don't have a Charm Telecon in December. That's a free month. And then when we start in early next year, some of the things we'll be talking about will be the dunes on Titan. When the Hyperion special issue comes out, we'll see if we can get a couple of the icy satellite scientists to come talk to us about Hyperion, maybe do a navigation tutorial. Those are some of the things that are on tap for early next year. And with that, we'll see you all in 1 month, and the last Tuesday in November. And have a great month.
Bye.
Bye. See you all next month.
Bye.
Thank you.